Deuteronomy 19, beginning of verse 14. We're getting into the area of Deuteronomy where we get to more specific directions to people. And the reason I like this is that we read in the New Testament that we are new creations created unto good works. And then there's another book there that Timothy, I believe it is. It's just the good works, good works, good works. We went over that, I believe, in one of our services earlier. And what are the good works? You know, what good works? I see those things in general terms. And then when I look at the law, I begin to see some very specifics where we need to concentrate on, and then extend ourselves out from those. If I do this particular step that's in the law, then how can I step out from that even further and follow that as my examples of doing good works? And so we come here to verse 14 in chapter 19, and it says, "You shall not remove your neighbor's landmark, which they of old time have set in your inheritance, which you shall inherit in the land that the Lord your God gives you to possess it." As they went into the land, the first thing that they were going to do after conquering it, of course, was to divide it up. First of all, into tribes, and then each of the tribes would divide it up according to families and all the way down to the individual people. And they would set themselves landmarks by raising piles of stones at the corner of their fields. And so the directions here to people, as time goes on, you are not supposed to move those piles of stones and change the landmarks. Okay, today we have them too. You know, I used to have a iron rod stuck down in the ground, and it was always in my way. So eventually, the neighbor had it resurveyed, and they got a one that's down in the ground with a big stone sticking up out of it. I buried the stone so that I could mow over it now, but at least we know where it's at. Okay, so. You know, it wasn't like I pulled the stone out and moved it over here, all right? That was very important here because it was a land-based economy that they were going to have. And each family was allotted that certain plot of land. And the law also states that the land was never to be transferred to another family. So to move the pile of stones that marked the corners was equivalent to stealing. So when we hear the general statement, "Thou shalt not steal," well, what's that mean to me? Okay, how am I going to implement that one particular thing in my life? Well, one way that I'm going to implement it is I'm not going to move the cornerstones from the land of my neighbor. I'm not going to scoot them over there so I get another quarter of an acre on my land, then take it away from them. Respect, the direction here is then respect the rights of others, no matter what the circumstances may be. Business should not be to see how much of someone else's property we can gobble up, but how we can best serve the customer. Life should not be a gain, more and more prospect, but how well do we manage what the Lord has given to us? Then, when we come to verses 15 through 19, if a witness rise up, excuse me, one witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity, or for any sin, in any sin that he sinneth, at the mouth of two witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. If a false witness rise up against any man to testify against him that which is wrong, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges, which shall be in those days. And the judges shall make diligent inquisition, and behold, if the witness be a false witness, and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you. And those which remain shall hear and fear, and shall henceforth commit no more any such evil among you. And thine eye shall not pity, but life shall go for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Never be swayed to condemn somebody on the testimony of one witness. There needs to be a preponderance of evidence against someone before you establish their guilt in a matter. This is a good practice to follow when making any of your life decisions. Just noticed on TV the other day, they had a little thing about eyewitnesses and how reliable they can be. And they are very, very unreliable. And so the poor man had been in jail for like 22 years or something and just got released because the woman that had testified against them had chosen the wrong person. And in fact, the guilty party was even sitting in the courtroom the day that she testified against this person. And she couldn't identify make the difference. And so for 22 years, this person's been sitting in jail. So you can't, as the Scripture tells us clearly here, it says don't take one person's testimony to convict someone. Make sure that there is plenty, two if not three, at the minimum now. All right, this is just minimum here. Make sure if you are in the position to judge somebody, you know, you're sitting on a jury, make sure that the person, that they have presented a superabundance of evidence against this person. And then, take care that the witnesses that you are here speaking the truth, are speaking the truth, and are not seeking to injure the person they have accused. When we hear somebody tell us something about somebody, you know, what are the motives? Why are you telling me this about this other person? What do you get out of this? Or why did I even need to know this about that person? If you have a responsibility to judge a false witness, the punishment should equal the harm that that person was trying to do to the other person. So, in the case of the false witnesses brought against Jesus, what should have been done to them? They were trying to get him crucified. Okay? So they should have been crucified themselves. A verdict and punishment should be clearly published. There's another point that comes out from these verses. As a method of teaching others not to do the same kind of evil. Do not be slack in meting out the punishment. This is more toward the judges in this case. When the decision comes down, it was to be published. Okay, I always read the decisions of our judges in the daily paper. Sentence, of course, was to be carried out. Then, very important here. Understand what life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot means. You hear it all the time, this statement, that if we followed this rule, we'd all be going around toothless and eyeless and blind and eyeless. Yeah, whatever. You know, you hear that? Okay, well, that's foolishness. It's foolish speaking. That is not what this means. The meaning of this phrase is that punishment should be equitable to the crime that was committed. It should not go beyond the crime. Okay? It should not be less than the crime. You go to the Arab nations, of course. Someone steals something. What was the punishment? You had got your hand cut off. Okay? Does that meet the crime? No. That's foolishness. In fact, the scriptures even addressed that. The punishment for stealing something was you've got to give it back plus something on top of it to show that so that you really understood that you were taking something. So this particular phrase is always taken out of what its true meaning and used to degrade what the scriptures are actually saying. Okay, the crime needs to be, the punishment needs to equal that. If the punishment is more than is needed, it creates disrespect for the law and those responsible for executing it. If the punishment is less, it fails to restrain the evil, for the people will not see justice working and will be tempted to continue to do what is wrong. So, equitable punishment for the crime. In chapter 20, we come to the laws pertaining to war. One of the things that I see, and it's an emotional thing about war, is that there tends to be, people tend to get carried away with it. And what I mean by that is that when we run up against enemies who have no belief in our God, they tend to act that way. And they will execute their wars that way. They will kill the innocent as well as those that the soldiers that are participating. They will have no mercy on people. They will wipe out the entire group if they're captured. They'll take no prisoners alive. So one of the things that I see happening is that, well, if we're fighting somebody like that, then we ought to just do what they're doing. And yet the scriptures tell us otherwise. Okay? The scriptures tell us otherwise. In verses 1 through 4 in chapter 20, it goes this way. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and a people more than you, be not afraid of them, for the Lord your God is with you, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be, when you are come nigh unto the battle, that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people. And they shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, you approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint, fear not, and do not tremble, neither be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. Unfortunately, we cannot take this passage and change the name of Israel to the United States. It has been used that way in the past and will be again by some good and but unthinking men. This is why I don't like the battle hymn of the Republic. However, there are some things for us today in this passage about warfare. Other than the upcoming battles in the taking of the Promised Land, Israel would be fighting defensive battles against invading armies. Even today, a defensive war can be shown to be a righteous war. If the people of a country are a righteous people, then the Lord comes to fight on their side. It is right and proper that we have chaplains with the understanding that only those that serve the true God are worth anything to the men to whom they minister. There was a priest of war in Israel. This priest was assigned to go with the army whenever they went to battle. His function was to see that the law of God was not violated by the soldiers during the fight. He also was there to encourage them and to allay their fear by teaching them from the law. As the battle approached, in verses 5 through 7, the officers shall speak unto the people, saying, "What man is there that has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he dies in the battle, and another man dedicates it. And what man is he that has planted a vineyard and has not yet eaten of it? Let him go, him also go and return to his house, lest he dies in the battle, and another man eats of it. And what man is there that has betrothed a wife and has not taken her? Let him go and return to his house, lest he dies in the battle, and another man takes her." There were three concerns of daily life that excused the man from service in the army. The officers were to make it clear, when the army was called together, that these men were to leave and go home. The first was a man who had built a new house, but had not moved into it yet. This would cause the man to be thinking of the care of his family more than the proper thought that he needed to give to do battle. The second was similar to the first, but involved the planting of a vineyard. A vineyard takes time to establish so that it will produce and provide for a man's family. He was excused to go make sure that provision for his family was secure. The third has to do with the betrothal process of the day. A man was considered to be married when he was betrothed. A man had to stay at home for one full year after the marriage was consummated. We'll see that in Deuteronomy 24:5. The purpose of this law was to give time for him to produce an heir so that the property that belonged to his family could be passed on to the next generation, and so his family name would not be blotted out of the nation. It might be well if we thought in some of these similar terms in our own country. The Lord appears to be telling us that the needs of the family outweigh the needs of the state. It's curious that the Lord uses something similar in his parable about the guest that would not come to the king's banquet in Luke 14. One, they all began to make excuse and said one had bought a piece of ground and needed to look at it, and another had bought five oxen, yoke of oxen, and needed to prove them, and another said, "I'm married and can't come." In Deuteronomy 20, verses 8 and 9, after those men were sent home, The officers shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say, What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest his brother's heart faint, as well as his heart. And it shall be, when the officers have made an end of speaking unto the people, that they shall make captains of the armies to lead the people. A final proclamation was made to all who were too fearful to fight. It was better to go into battle undermanned than to have those who would turn and run at the first encounter, for they would not only get in the way, but they would cause others to follow them. In general, it took a truly fearful person to leave and return to his house. The best example in Scripture of this law being followed is in the battle led by Gideon. In this instance, 22,000 out of the 32,000 that came left because of fear. There was not to be a standing army in Israel. The army was always called together from volunteers when a war was declared. This is a good practice for any country. Israel was not to be an aggressor state. The purpose of a fight was to protect the country from invasion by others. Verses 10 through 15. When you come near to a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make you answer of peace and open unto you, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto you, and they shall serve you. And if it will make no peace with you, but will war against you, then you shall besiege it. And when the Lord your God hath delivered it into your hands, you shall smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. But the women and the little ones and the cattle and all that is in the city, even all the spoil thereof, shall you take unto yourselves, and you shall eat the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus shall you do unto all the cities which are very far off from you, which are not of the cities of these nations. The Lord is a God of peace, not war. Therefore, when the Israelites had to fight against the city-state, their first requirement was to send a peace mission. Their message was, Open your city to us and place yourselves under our authority, and you shall live and keep what is yours. They were then required to pay an annual tribute and to be allies with Israel. If that city refused to make peace, Israel was to besiege it until the Lord gave them victory. When the city fell, all the males 20 and up were to be killed, but the women and children were to be saved alive, but placed as servants, and all livestock and other valuables were to be divided as spoil to the soldiers. This was to be a rule for all the cities except the cities of Canaan, of the Canaanites. This offer of peace was even made to the Canaanites if they would vacate the land. In our daily lives, when we are offended by someone, our first reaction should be to settle the matter peaceably and not seek reprisal. Better to gain a friend than to seek the demise of an enemy. The Lord teaches us this in Matthew 18, where He says, Moreover, if thy brother trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. If he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. But if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more, that in the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he neglect to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he neglect to hear the church, let him be unto thee as an heathen man and a publican. Then in Deuteronomy 20:16 through 18, but of the cities of these people which the Lord your God does give you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that they teach you not to do after all their abominations which they have done unto their gods, so should you sin against the Lord your God. These particular verses apply only to the section of the laws of war dealing with those cities that chose to fight. The judgment of God came upon the Canaanites, or upon the Canaanites, was that they would lose their land because of the gross immorality that they did in their idol worship. They had three options. One was to move out of the land. The example of this were the Girgashites I mentioned before. And they moved out before Israel came in to conquer them. The second was to submit and stop their idol worship and worship Jehovah. The example of this one is... the Canaanites. Only one family actually accepted it. From Jericho, Rahab. And the other one, of course, was to fight to the death, which they chose. If they chose the third, all living things, men, women, children, and animals, were to be killed. The reason was that anyone left living would teach the Israelites to do the abominations that they had done. The accuracy of this reason is proved in that the Israelites eventually turned to some of the abominations because not all of the Canaanites were done away with. The spiritual lesson for us is that we must choose our friends carefully. One rotten apple spoils the whole bunch, the whole barrel is not a nonsense thing. The church is not an all-inclusive organization. It is composed only of true worshipers of God through Jesus Christ. Those who worship another god have no part in it. If non-believers are included, they will introduce ungodly worship that will turn away many to unbelief. Verses 19 to 20. When you shall besiege a city a long time in making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy the trees thereof by forcing an axe against them, for you may eat of them, and you shall not cut them down. For the tree of the field is man's life, to employ them in the siege. Only the trees which you know, that they be not trees for meat, you shall destroy and cut them down, and you shall build bulwarks against the city that makes war with you until it be subdued. When it was necessary to do battle with an enemy, there was not to be a scorched earth policy. Needless destruction was forbidden. This is seen in the law about not cutting down trees that produce fruit that can be eaten. Food is one of the provisions of God, and a follower of God does not deny food, even to an enemy, once they have submitted. The trees would be that food provision once peace had been made. And I think I'll stop there because we go into a different section and time's fleeting.